it's highly limited. So where's the energy going to come from to fly this copter with the huge blades, this rover on Mars? Over to you, Paul.
Hey, clear, Jay.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I read an article the other day about the deployment of energy, Oakland National Laboratory at NASA, that they're actually making fuel for them. That's something that hasn't been done in a long time, so it's probably going to be looking good for them in the future.
What? I missed what he said.
Okay, yeah. You might have, Paul, do you want Eric to repeat what he just said? Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, Eric, I heard them making something. I missed what you said. That would be important. Back to you, Eric.
I read an article a couple of weeks ago about NASA, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and the Department of Energy, and they're making fuel for the OGV.
Fuel, oh, okay, very good, very good. Okay, yeah, plutonium 238.
We didn't hear what you said, Eric. You keyed the mic too fast.
I believe that's correct.
And so, from what you know, Eric, now that Oak Ridge has been turned back on to do this, my guess is the rate at which you produce plutonium-238 is very slow, is my guess. I mean, if you want a few kilograms of that stuff, you may have to wait a couple of years. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
I really don't have the answer to that, but the way the article was written, and I think it actually was an NASA article I was reading, that they're going to be able to make sufficient quantity for what they need. I don't remember whether it was a breeder that they fired up or some methodology which makes it possible for them to generate fuel specifically for NASA.
There may be another way. By way of the arms agreement between us and the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, a lot of nuclear-tipped missiles have been disassembled. And I think there's a plutonium seed inside of those. Can we recover those to get the fuel that we need for radioactive thermal generators? What's your guess on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, KQLIW?
Now, again, the way the article was written, it sounds like they're manufacturing it as opposed to repurposing cereal.
Yeah, but the word manufacturing could really be taking the material out of these former weapons and re-engineering it into a different shape, a different alloy, and so on. So are they really starting a breeder reactor and slowly growing plutonium? I'm a little bit skeptical of that because I think it's a slow process. Maybe I'm wrong. Over to you, Eric.
No, I can't give you an answer to that, Dick, because I really don't know. But I dig up the article when I get to work tomorrow and read it again.
Do you just think, Paul, we're giving Eric a homework assignment? Another question I've got for you, Paul. Our commercial space business people are now getting more and more skilled at taking the first stage of the booster and flying it back home, so to speak. Now, some of these launch vehicles have 2 and 3 stages. Have there been any talk about recovering the second stage? Or is that too far downrange and not valuable enough and not worth the effort? WS2N, KQLIW.
I know SpaceX is working on that, and to go back to the first to a previous question that you asked, I didn't answer. Where are they getting the power to fly the helicopter? And it's not really a drone. It's like you're not going to see four different quad. It's not going to be a quadcopter. It's just going to be single shaft coming up with two blades, one going clockwise, the other one counterclockwise. On top of that, if you look down on the helicopter, you see this big round patch, and the round patch is a bunch of solar cells. So that will recharge the copter, you know, during the day when it's not used. And if they get a minute or two at flight per week or so, they'd be happy with it. So I wanted to answer that question first. Back to you, then.
Wow. So you spend the whole week charging your solar cell. Your solar cells charge your batteries, and the battery gives you a couple of minutes of flight. And this counter-rotating helicopter-like thing is going to burn up energy like crazy because that atmosphere is so thin. And when you're slowly moving a rover across the surface, you've got a lot of fallback if anything goes wrong. If you run into a rock, you run into a pebble, you run into a hole, you run into a divot. When you're flying a flying machine and something goes wrong and you have a rough landing and the blade strikes the ground and becomes damaged, or you run out of power while you're at some particular altitude, the number of failure mechanisms for which there's very poor recovery on a flying machine strikes me as a very high risk approach. You've got a lot more mobility, that's the good news. You can get from here to there faster, but the probability of getting there and being in one piece, maybe it's one-tenth of what it would be with something that rolls across the surface. So I'm a bit skeptical as to whether or not this will really come about, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I hope it does, because the NASA presentation had to do with, you know, suppose the rover is here and they show a picture of, you know, what the rover would be looking at. And, you know, a simulated landscape. And then, suppose you just wanted to know, what was over that little ridge, you know? And is it going to pay for us to bring our rover over there and, you know, set up the whole rover to run chemical tests and everything? But then they show, okay, here's the helicopter, and the helicopter takes the picture, and they can see exactly what's there, if it's rough terrain or if it's what they're looking at. So I hope it works out. Back to you, Dick. Now I'll go on with the movement.
Of all the data we've gathered about Mars, Spirit, Opportunity, and the third one, the great big one, I can't think of the name of it right now, Curiosity, has made a whole lot of measurements in a whole lot of areas, a whole lot of evidence of water being once, liquid water once being on the surface of Mars. Maybe a lot more atmosphere, maybe a magnetic field. Now it has no magnetic field, no Van Allen belt, very little atmosphere, very little liquid water on the surface, some frozen water below the surface. So when you put this all together, the chances of us finding evidence of life or past life on Mars, aren't we sort of running out of opportunities for saying that, here's evidence that Mars at least had microbial life at one time, and by way of all of the radiation that's there now, all of the bombardment from space, it died off. So from what we now know, what's the probability of Mars now having or once having had life? WS2N, K2IW.
I don't know what the probability is. I know they're still pushing to look under the ground. InSight will be going up in 2 years, 2018. That will drive a big hole into the, down into the surface. They think maybe possibly underground you might have microbial life. The European Space Agency is betting on it with their rover. Their rover going up in 2020. Well, that was supposed to go up in 2018, but that's behind schedule. It's solar powered. Even China's got a planned vehicle going up for 2020. They're all still betting that they can find something, but I don't know. I'm not that good with the biological end of things. I hope they find something, you know, a little amoeba or something, anything. But we'll have to wait and see. The booster story, Falcon 9 is landing boosters left and right. They've now successfully landed 10 Falcon 9 boosters, over 150 foot high, 12 diameter, 12 foot diameter boosters back either on land or on these autonomous drone ships. They've successfully landed back in Cape Canaveral four times, one time out in the Pacific Ocean when they launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base, and five times out in the Atlantic Ocean, and then they've floated back. So 10 successful boosters have brought back. In the beginning, they used to crash them on the deck of the autonomous ships. Sometimes they didn't even have a ship out there. They were just testing things, and they would land in the ocean. People would come, you know, come down vertically. But now they used to call them experimental landings on their website. They've taken that down. Now it's just going to be routine. We're bringing all our boosters back, or most of the boosters back. They do have one going up, I think, within a couple of weeks. We drop it. Again, from Launch Complex 39A, and that's the same complex that Saturn rockets took off to go to the moon, and over half the amount of shuttles took off from that launch complex. Now SpaceX is using it. They've launched a couple of flights from there already, and now they're going to do another one. And that boost, they are not going to recover. Very heavy load. They plan on putting it into a geosynchronous orbit, and that's going to be an expendable booster. But most of them, they're going to, return either back to land if they have enough fuel. And if they have a lot of fuel but not enough to get back to land, they'll land on the autonomous boosters. These things are as big as a football field out in the middle of the ocean, and then float them back vertically all the way back to land. As far as the next step, they've already successfully brought back the fairing, $6 million fairing covers that cover the spacecraft from the drop. Elon Musk put nitrogen jets on board that to guide them in such a way where they can come through the atmosphere after opening up and letting the second stage in the spacecraft go on its way. And normally they just, several blasts or burn up in the atmosphere. They're coming down and they have parachutes on them, and they've already successfully brought back one half. The other half, I guess they couldn't find, or maybe it was too damaged. So, that's their goal, is to bring these expensive bearings back and reuse them. And the long-term goal is the second stage, which is really one engine on board. The Papa 9 has 9 Merlin 1D engines. That's what I call the Papa 9 booster. They're bringing that back successfully. So the second stage just has one of those Merlin 1D engines. Especially made for vacuum use in space. And that thing, they would like to bring that back. Presently, all these heavy lift vehicles, the Atlas V, Ariane 5 by European Space Agency, the Russians, they all take their final stage, whatever it might be, second or third stage, and right after it separates the payload, they have nitrogen jets on some of them, and they can just reaction control jets, and they'll turn that last final stage in the case of SpaceX, the second stage, and they'll turn it and relight the engine and bring it back to deorbit it, and usually winds up in the ocean somewhere. Now, this last flight that they had that they launched from Cape Canaveral, they did something a little different. Instead of bringing it back and landing it into the North Atlantic, when we drop it. This WS2, he let it go into a complete orbit all the way around, and then when it got back over Florida, and he orbited it at that point, and then let it come back down, and they haven't recovered it yet. But but his goal is eventually, I don't know how many years it's going to take, but he's really seriously looking into doing this. He might need some kind of heat shield. I'm not sure how he's going to develop this, but if anybody can do it, Elon Musk can. And they had talked about this, oh, I remember this, 6, 7 years ago when he was really starting up the flights going to the International Space Station. They were talking about eventually bringing back the second stage. Then a year or two went by and he gave up. Doesn't want to, it's just too expensive. We're going to wait many years from that. Now he's so successful at bringing the boosters back, he's starting in again, that he'd like to redo, you know, start developing a system where it's possible to bring that final stage back to a successful landing and eventually reuse it. Dragon, let me drop it. Dragon vehicle that they use to bring the cargo to the space station right now is not reusable. It's been designed to be reusable, but NASA said that's it. We want all brand new ones. So he's got a second version of the cargo vehicle that he's developing that will come back. Instead of coming back to the Pacific Ocean now, right now that's where they all land, and then they send the boat out, SpaceX sends the boat out, and they bring back the Dragon successfully, you know, back to land. This way they can bring back all the science material, whatever is in the International Space Station bases that they want to bring back. Anything that has to come back comes back, except for people. But the second version of the cargo vehicle will have propulsion engines on it, and instead of coming back with a heat shield and a parachute and land in the Pacific Ocean, it's going to come back and eventually land on land, bringing all the science equipment directly back to the scientists instead of waiting for it to float off the boat. And that's what I know about it, Dick. Back to that, WS1.
You keep saying that the boosters came back to the Pacific Ocean. When you're making a Cape Canaveral launch, Kennedy Space Center launch, you're launching over the Atlantic Ocean, so wouldn't the booster be coming back to the Atlantic Ocean if it doesn't come back to Kennedy Space Center? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, there's four different locations I'm talking about. When you launch from Cape Canaveral, first stage booster of the Falcon 9, the 9 engines, and the oxygen tank and the kerosene tank, so one piece comes back and lands in the Atlantic Ocean on a drone ship, or they might bring it back, if it has enough fuel on it, they might bring it back and land it at Cape Canaveral. Again, another vertical landing with four legs sticking out. Then the other two locations is in the Pacific Ocean. Sometimes they launch rockets from Vandenberg Air Force Base. They've taken over launch complex 4E, completely taken it over, just like they've done on the East Coast. And they launched their rockets from there. They launched the Jason rocket, and they launched the Cassiopeia. They launched that one. And recently they launched 10 Iridium NEXT satellites from California. So now, when that goes up, the nine engine booster came down, and in one case they successfully landed that in the Pacific Ocean on a barge out there. They have two barges, by the way, one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast. This guy's got a lot of money. They don't have to send the barge through the Panama Canal. If they're going to have another launch somewhere in a different part of the country, let me drop it. And last part I'm talking about is the Dragon spacecraft itself that takes all the cargo, that's the payload, and brings it to the International Space Station. When that docks at the space station, unlike the other cargo vehicles that go to the International Space Station to supply cargo, such as the HTV by Japan or the Russian Progress vehicle or the Orbital ATK that sends Cygnus up, all those vehicles come back and they burn up above the Pacific Ocean, completely burn up, where SpaceX is the only one that actually flies all the way back, and they fly back with the Dragon spacecraft. It separates from the space station, comes down with a heat shield and then parachute, and then it lands in the Pacific Ocean. It's picked up by one of the SpaceX boats. Maybe that's a little clearer than H-R-I-W, W-S-2-N.
Yes, it is. In the case of launches from Vandenberg, I would guess that no return to Vandenberg has occurred yet. Those launches were either on the barge out in the Pacific or in the water itself, so Paul, is that true?
Not sure. I read he said he's ready, but he needs a clearance from the FAA, the FCC. The FAA needs to approve his have a booster come back. So I guess that's not too far down the line. He's got the approval on the East Coast. I don't know what the problem is on the West Coast. I don't know, maybe California is a little bit more finicky about gigantic boosters flying over what they might perceive as flying over all their homes and condominiums. I don't know why that's being delayed, but I know he had the capability a couple of years ago. I don't know. Back to
you. I've been to the Vandenberg Air Force Base area. There's a lot of residential homes fairly nearby, so I can see why you have to have FAA approval. If you're flying a booster back to Vandenberg, and Vandenberg is not a huge base, is my impression, it's a relatively small target. And if you miss that target, you could land in somebody's backyard. And I guarantee that would make them unhappy, so I can see how the approval out there is going to be a little bit more difficult. Did say that the fairing, that he's now trying to recover fairings, that they're worth $6 million. I assume the fairing is a very fancy piece of fiberglass covering over a spacecraft to get it through the atmosphere on the way up. What makes the fairing that expensive, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, I know it's an aluminum fiberglass structure. They're pushed apart from one another using, they don't use pyrotechnics, they use pneumatics, some kind of pneumatic system that separates them. And they're large, you know, I mean, you look at some of these satellites, they're, you know, 35 feet long, and they're bearing them, you know, like four stories tall. In some cases, they're 5 meters in diameter. You know, they have 4 meter diameter ones, but a lot of them are 5 meter diameter. This is 5.2 meters for their large version in diameter. So, expensive pieces of equipment. They have to connect to the second stage properly. Apparently, there's a lot of machining and things that go into making these things. So he figures if he could save another $6 million, he'll do it. I'm assuming it's $3 million for each half. That's my guess. So, I don't know. After this topic, I just wanted to bring up one other topic that's going on the International Space Station that they just did the other day back in there.
Go ahead with the topic on the ISS, Paul, K2RIW.
At the very end of April, I think it was the 27th, I'll have to check the date, but let's call it the very end of April, they detected a problem with the electrical system on board. They have these four boxes located, and they're large boxes, each one is probably as big as a suitcase. And they control, you know, each one controls power coming back from a set of solar arrays, and then it goes through this box, converts all the power down to where, to the proper voltage, and distributes it to wherever it has to go. So it's a big bumping type of connection. I'm envisioning relays or something inside of the thing. But it has controllers to do this. If one system acts up, it can be converted to another different location. So they have redundancy built in. One of these boxes, they were not getting data from. So NASA in Houston could not control anything if they wanted to. It was working fine, but right away they saw a problem. It's no good, and they have all kinds of flight rules. If something comes up, it becomes the top priority. Drop it. If another part of the electrical system would fail, they would not be able to control it, and they would normally send the telemetry up to this box and say, okay, do this, do that. Send it to this, you know, A or B. So because of this problem, it's creeped up back in 2012, so 5 years ago, in another box, one of these four big boxes. And they changed it out with a spacewalk. And spacewalks take more time to set up. It was dangerous. If they could ever avoid doing that, they would. What they have on board, and they've been testing it more and more over the years, is this Dextra robotic thing. They call it Dextra. It's got a big arm, torso. They move it around with 57-foot robotic arm, put it anywhere they want on the space station. And so essentially, it's a big robot. And they started to use it this time to unbolt everything from this box. Disconnect connectors and relocate, take the box out, put another box in where, you know, it has apparently spares and we're bought up. To make a long story short, they got this thing working, and without an EVA, very happy. They installed it, they got their data, and everything's working fine. But it was a priority thing that came up, and sure enough, the robotics have come a long way where they're able to do something like this without an EVA back here.
So this is a remotely controlled out of the out in space on the outside of the habitable structure. This thing replaced a major module, unplugged the connectors, unscrewed it, and whatever, all by way of robotic control, if I understand correctly. It does sound like we're coming a long way with repair vehicles. So you and I are looking forward to the day when there'll be a repair vehicle that can go to Hubble. That's going to be needed. I'm pretty sure we're never going to want to give up on Hubble for a long time to come. So, and I guess, I think you're saying that these power modules that go in between the solar cells and the rest of the power electronics, when you get a failure one of those, it's probably declared a very high priority so-called safety of flight, because I guess you have at least two of these, and if one fails and you're only on the second one, and if it should fail you lose all power on the satellite, I guess his life starts getting very complicated very fast. So they probably call this a safety of flight issue. That's a guess on my part. Up all WS2N KQRIW.
I don't remember what I read, what they actually called it, but it became a priority. But yeah, they might have used those words. But the box is supposed to be very heavy. I mean, not that I'm out of space, but you can imagine the electronics and stuff. I downloaded a picture of what one would look like. And they are large. Well, they use centimeters. I think they said one was 100 centimeters high and 40 centimeters wide, and that type of thing. It was like a big suitcase. And the weight, they went by with kilograms. I think it was 100 kilograms, so it was a little over 200 pounds. And they have spares up there. These four boxes, when they were developed, they were developed for 15-year use. And since they first started coming online around 2002 to through 2006, four boxes were eventually installed as the station was being built. So time is getting, starting to go by, and it's starting to get old. So they've outlived their lifetime. So they have plans of sending new ones up with the cargo vehicles. And they've had those plans anyway. Maybe they'll just accelerate them. This is the second one that they've had trouble with over the last, in the last 5 years. So, let me drop it. They're located all on the same truss piece. The main truss piece is actually, the main supporting truss piece is called zero truss piece, which they don't use the 1/8, it's called zero. And it's mounted to the Discovery module, which is the American. Destiny module, which is the American module. That's where we have all our science and everything. That's our name on the module. That's the backbone of this whole truss setup. From zero, you go out to one. S1, S2. Well, there is no S2. S3, S4, S5, S6. And then port side, you have port 1. Again, no port 2, port 3, 4, 5, 6. So you have 11 pieces. And all these four big boxes are located on the zero truss section. So they're, roughly in the middle of the space station. So they're able to get to it, no problem. And what I find fascinating is that the astronauts have nothing to do with it. It's not like they're in there, operating, joysticks and controlling this thing and doing it. It's all being controlled by Houston. They're the ones that, you could be an astronaut and you could be sleeping away, and then Houston is moving these boxes around outside your space station. Back to the...
So this box that got replaced by remote control is a power module of some kind. Is there a total of four of them on board, on pole? Is that what I heard you say? Does that mean we've got a 3-to-1 redundancy, so to speak? Go ahead.
Now you have, 8 sets of solar arrays. For every 2 sets, utilize one of these boxes. And, and then what happens is, you have all four working. You could not have one working, you're just going to have less amperage coming into the space station. So when all four are running, that means all the solar panels are functioning properly, charging their batteries, and they're coming through this MBSU box. There's MBSU box, which is one of their acronyms for a main bus switching unit. So it's really a big switching unit. Controls, one quarter of the station. So each one controls a quarter of the station. One fails, in this case, they place the whole box with the other ones that they have on station. Physically remove it, put another one on. That's what these robots, there's a Canadian robot arm and Dextra. Back to you.
In the worst case, going down to 3/4, 1/2, or 1/4 of the power to run the space station, and how much workaround wiring do they have? If you've got a failure on the starboard side, is there a way you can take port side power and, inside the space station and bring it over to the starboard side? There may not be that kind of switching capability. This box kept working, but the telemetry to it, they weren't getting information to it or from it. Is that what was the main reason it needed replacement? That combined with the fact that it was near end of life as far as years of service? Over to you, Paul.
And by the way, they do have a jumper set up. I guess you could do an EVA. Our jumper cable, my quote, jumper cable. I guess they had an alligator clip, but probably these big, I would imagine what they're a real push-in type of connectors. But they call them jumper connectors. that they can go from one side to the other as a backup. So, he said something else about the box. I don't remember what you asked me exactly.
Did this box get replaced because they lost communication to it and from it? The telemetry failed, combined with the fact that maybe its years of service such that it was coming to the end of life? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what happened. They lost the ability to control the box. Who knows what they see on their screen, Maybe something comes back, unit failure or something. I don't know. And they probably go to try to, see what the problem is, energize it, or if they're able to get any kind of data from it. They were getting nothing. How they go about doing that, I don't know, but they do have the ability to check that this thing is not responding. So that means, let's say, they're going from normally from A to A, and something creeps up on A down range, and they want to be able to bypass it. They could normally do that, sitting in their consoles and using it. They could just say, okay, box, send it to this location. Or maybe not send anything anywhere. Maybe they don't even have the ability to shut it down. Who knows? They can't have that. That's their priority. So, as it is, they have an EVA plan for this Friday anyway, but they wouldn't have been that part of that, wouldn't have been part of that EVA. It would have been a completely separate EVA. So that's now unnecessary to do. So we always talk about, how far these robots are getting. Yeah, they are. They came over the problem a week or so ago, and it's already solved. HURIWWS.
This box that got replaced, is it called a power control unit, power control switching unit? Does it have a name like that, Paul?
Yeah, they call it an MBSU. They call it a main bus switching unit. So the way I've read it is, you take 160 volts about that coming in, from the panels, and then that gets regulated somewhere before it even gets to this thing. On the end of the arm, the end of the truss section, they have these batteries, massive batteries. Now they're replacing them with lithium ion batteries, but 500 pound batteries, and a whole bunch of them. So it's charging that, then going apparently into some kind of regulated setup, which they say, gives you 150 volts. Actually, it's down to 124 volts, 124 point something, probably 124.5 volts. And then it goes into this box. Now, from this box, they can send it anywhere they want in their space station. They can even send it to the Russians. In fact, they do send power to the Russian segment from it. It's weird, the Russians use 28 volts DC. We actually, by the time we get it, they actually convert it to AC inside the space station, I've read. So, weird, it's like, I guess you can plug in your electric razor back to you.
So, do I understand correctly, Paul, that much of the American section is maybe running on 120 or 240, 60 cycle AC, whereas much of the Russian section is running on 28 volts DC? Is that approximately what's going on here?
Yeah, I've read that many times over the years, so I'm willing to believe that's still the case. I find it hard to believe they went that way. They also have a system, Russians have some panels over there too, some solar panels. In an emergency, as a backup, they have converters, up converters, where they can send their power back to the Americans and convert back to 120 AC if they wanted to. So in both directions they can go. That I've read a number of times too, so that's a backup system.
So it sounds like much of the equipment in the American section is running on stateside power, I'm going to call it. Ordinary power that you've got in an ordinary laboratory. And so that makes purchasing equipment off the shelf a lot easier. if you and I had to buy test equipment that runs on 28 volts because you don't want to build 60 cycle converters, I think that means everything is a special. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I think it all affects the diameter of the wires. I mean, even when I first started reading about the 28 volts, that's like standard operating procedure with all these satellites that are up there. You know, our own satellites included. You know, why didn't they use 12 volts? The articles I read, you can use a smaller diameter wire to do the same purpose. Smaller the diameter, the lighter it is. I mean, they try to save every ounce that they can everywhere. So if you have a big satellite, you can save, you know, 20 pounds of copper, I guess. They do it. And then all the modern satellites, the last 10, 15 years, I guess, maybe 20 years, they're using, I think they call it space wire. And what they do is they just have a bunch of little power, single power wires going to all the different equipment on a satellite. Drop it. And then one common ground. And then instead of sending, let's say you had a magnetometer on one end, you had a gyroscope on another one. You wanted to control all these things at different speeds and different directions. Instead of sending like 20 wires to the gyroscope and another 30 wires out to the magnetometer or some other piece of equipment that a solar panel has to move or something, 20 different wires, each one, because each one had to do a certain different thing. It was just that one wire, for power, ground, and then another power, one other wire, and then a computer that sends signals, data signals to each piece of equipment on the satellite. And so, your one wire transmitting, bits of digital data to each particular instrument. You might have 11 instruments on board your satellite, telling each one what to do. But it's all doing it with just one wire going to one central computer processing unit. And if you get called space wire, you got to think like the mini internet, So they do everything to save power. But I think it's all running on 28 volts and all this stuff. Back to this.
As you know, Paul was not successful. We don't have Echolink. We don't have IRLP. So an awful lot of the people that could be listening or signing in from far off areas are not there tonight. All we've got is just the direct repeater coverage from New York City, from Queens. So unless you've got some other important subjects, Paul, I think we should cut it off a little bit short tonight because we're almost all alone, if you know what I mean. WS2N, K2IW.
No problem. I wonder if they can record it, and I wonder if the recordings will go through. But yeah, it's fine with me. And I know I tried these. I tried Zeldin before. Rather than running at high power, I was going to switch over like I did last week. But I see it's completely still off. So I'll turn it back to you, Dirk. I'll be listening out. Somebody has something. WS2N back in it.
So we're quite possibly going to discontinue early tonight. Anybody have any further questions or comments they want to place before we go away? Give me a call, letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
Nobody home, Dick. I'm going to go watch the 60 Minute show you told me about. I recorded that.
Okay. This was TechNet number 1649. That was Space Report number 249 of the series. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW clear.
Real good. 73, Dick. Anybody else that's still out there? Have a good night. WS2N clear. We'll be back next week.
KC2WGB, good evening, Wes.
Catch on, what's going on?
Nothing too much. Didn't have anything to add for the TechNet tonight, so they closed a little early. Not bad. But interesting space topics. But other than that, nothing much is going on.
Net time complete.
Yeah, I wasn't sitting very well, so I wasn't on the TechNet. We've got terrible flu. You know, like some people say, I never got sick. Oh, yeah. Then when they got sick good time, big time. Interesting.
Yeah, that happens to some people. You know, they're fine for a long time, and then when they get sick, they really get sick. Like right now, I'm having some dizziness, but other than that, I'm doing well.
It haunts me since Tuesday. No, yes, Tuesday. And the most difficult was yesterday, before yesterday, the last 2 days. My cousin checking up on me, on actually Poland. And to actually.
So what do you basically have, a cold or flu? What do you think?
All possible symptoms. At first, I had a slight raised temperature, but I'm going to operate in Celsius. So 36.6 is normal. And I have a various of scientific thermometers, and it was showing me 40. But it wasn't showing me 40, it was starting from 35.4, so it's below the temperature, but then it was going up, up, and up. So I decided I'm going to go to Wilbur's and buy my regular thermometer. All of a sudden, this one goes crazy. At first, at the store, shows me 35.1, which is much below. But by the time I came home, it was already 37.4. So that was a problem. But my wife was there yet. She was living that night. And she gave me some medicine. And she said to my cousin, so she checked on me twice, 3 times a day.
Okay, well, I set the thermometer, and you don't want it to go too high. If it's if it goes over 102 Fahrenheit, I would see a doctor.
Well, the funny thing is because today, again, I had the temperature below. So 36.6 is normal, 37 is higher, 38 is you sick, really, and 40 you dying. Actually, you can still survive for some time, and to actually.
Well, if you climb 105, 106, that's extremely dangerous, and you don't want to let it get anywhere near that, because that can be signs of many different things. So, yeah, keep an eye on that for sure.
I have a telephone number to Dr. Warren in case something happens. I told my my cousin check up on me tomorrow. She was checking 3 times a day. Seems to be better, much better. I couldn't eat for the past few days. I don't know, I was eating something, but not much. And now I was able to get a few eggs, fried eggs, within the period of 4 hours. piece by piece into a tree.
Yeah, get the protein and try to get some juice, whether it's pineapple juice or orange juice, stuff like that. That helps a little bit, as far as I know, for people. I know it helped me also. But, yeah, watch your diet when you have a fever. And you don't want to make yourself sick. So, yeah, but I would watch that thermometer like a hawk.
I don't believe it's going to get worse. I mean, from the way that I'm talking now, I wouldn't be able to talk 2 days ago like that. I was 99% in a bed. 1% just going to the bathroom, that's all. And to exit.
Okay,
do
you have any aches or pains?
They do.
Okay, yeah, I would keep Dr. Roy informed. He would be able to give you some tips of what you can do.
I have his telephone number. If it gets worse, I can call 911. I can call Dr. Roy first. I can call my cousin to be here for me. And I can, do so many things. So nothing is going to happen to me. It is better now. I do actually.
AC2WGB, how far is the emergency room from you?
With my car, about 25 minutes.
Ooh, that's a long drive. Someone's not feeling well. You might be better off calling 911, because if you're incapacitated in any way, you don't want to drive. Not good.
I'm keeping control of everything. Keeping control. That means I'm ready in case it worsens to react, so at least somebody knows. But I don't believe it's gonna get worse. It was worse. It wasn't that bad all my life. I didn't go to the doctor for 50 years, John. And to next year.
Yeah, I know. People healthy as a horse until they die. Do you have any aspirin in the house? Not Tylenol, but aspirin. Two aspirins, and then check your temperature, see if it goes down.
I do have.
Okay, you might want to try that, after you talk to Dr. Roy, see what he does. But, yeah, definitely keep an eye on that. Do you have a headache, pain in the head?
No, I don't have a headache, and again, temperature is below the level. The strange thing that I have noticed when I got sick, within 1 hour, half an hour, the temperature was jumping up and down. Was jumping, simply. So it was like a regular flu, right? But I never got a flu. Did you ever hear from me that I was sick?
Not that I recall, no. But, a low-grade fever is just as bad as an elevated temperature, so you want to be on that normal range.
Yeah, so that's what I'm doing is periodically I'm checking on all of the thermometers that I have. They put that shitty stuff, I'm sorry. We had the regular thermometers in Poland made with mercury. That was the best stuff. They have an electronic one right now, and this thing shows me every time different. That makes you.
Yep, I like the glass bulb thermometers myself, and I wouldn't bounce around with the instrumentation. I would find one that is responsive and use that one only. Because if you're changing thermometers, there's no way to know what's what.
No, I used to get the average. So I have some really fancy stuff to get the average. And then I've got the regular one for the people to use it. Electronic. John, what ironic time it is. And to MCM.
I still have a bunch of old mercury thermometers. I have two or three of them. And they'll basically read the same thing, but I use one specifically because I know I can count on it. But I don't like the digital blood pressure or the digital thermometers. I don't trust them. I found that they're inconsistent. Either, you know, one reading, and directly after that you take another reading, maybe 3 minutes later, and it's another reason. It's another temperature difference. So I don't know why it does that, where the bulk thermometers don't seem to do that, and the panicle blood pressures seem to be consistent.
Yeah, I mean, all my life, I remember my mother when she was alive. We've been using only mercury base. Good stuff. Never light. And to extreme.
Been sick for a couple of days, so I guess there's nothing new happening, huh?
No, I sort of keep a note what's going on. Okay. It was Tuesday. Tuesday I had a slight fever, but I didn't have the thermometer, the electronic yet. So I came home and was sort of okay, apart from the fact that I was I was warmer in all my body. And my wife was still there, so said, okay, you gotta go to the doctor. But I said, no, let me be at home. So evening time, she gave me some medication, some aspirin, I don't know that stuff, but she gave me, and I felt better. And I had a little bit of drowny nose and coughing, but very slightly. So she gave me whatever it is for it. It stopped. Then the next day, I feel like I don't want to wake up. So my wife offered me, do you want to eat something, whatever? And no. The whole day I was just drinking tea and interesting stuff. I'm a coffee drinker. I couldn't drink coffee. I made coffee and couldn't drink it. Okay, so the next day, temperature was below, and nothing really happened to me apart from the fact that I had a tremendous pain in the back. So I said, okay, I was all day in the bed and all night in the bed, so that's what I'm getting. Okay. And then evening time I got a fever. And then the next day, actually I lost how many days? Okay. Friday my wife's supposed to fly. So I took her to the airport. And my cousin was told to take care of me. And so she's checking on me twice, three times a day. So I feel pretty secure. And to extreme.
Okay, at least there's an improvement, and that's what you want to count on. But rest is important. That's when your body gets a chance to make those repairs. So do that. And I had a friend stop by today. He just come back from Poland. He was there 3 months. He has some family in northern Poland. He said it was like miserable North Pole up there.
The
3 months was too much.
Oh, yeah. Cold is much colder, but it's not like Moscow is. But it's much colder. I have still my father and father-in-law in Poland. So, I mean, my wife is calling me also and trying to check on me. No, I got to take care. I got care. Let's say, okay. So when I came home, right, it was like a pain for me to even go out, but I had to take my wife to airport. and I came